You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Now, Tracy, to your point in the green room, we're just going to start over. I'll take us into this one. You can take us into the next one. I noticed, by the way, for the benefit of our listeners who can't see you right now, that you shaved half your head, dyed the other half white, which means that X-Men 97 season 2 must be on. And you're just like,
yes, clearly. Yeah.
A huge fan of Storm.
Like, that's the move. That's the move. Yeah. Ironically. But then again, also completely predictably, because this is me that we're talking about here. Yes, X-Men season 2 of X-Men 97 is on. Have I watched it yet? No, I haven't. Now, in my defense, I promised to watch it with my son, Corwin, which means my opportunity to do this is like quickly narrowing, because we're in August and he's moving back to college at the end of this month. So like, I need to get on my horse here, but also other things intervene. Yeah. So like, we're working on it.
I know that is one of your favorites. So it's probably the closest thing to your to be watched list. Like, it's probably at the top.
Yeah, it really, it is. It very much is. And it's also an interesting time for me because Corwin got started a couple of years ago reading Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Actually, he got started way more than a couple of years ago. He got started about 10 years ago when I had him. I had some subscriptions for delivery comics to our house. And he was reading, like, I exercised mom powers at that point because he didn't know he could, like, just request stuff. And so I started grabbing things that were just launching at that time so he could get in on the ground floor. And I went with all the Babe comics. So he had Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. He had a subscription to Ironheart. He had a subscription to Squirrel Girl. He had a subscription to holy shit, I'm completely blanking on, anyway, all of them, all the chicks. And he dug them and he read them and he still has them and all of that. And then he kind of fell off the wagon for a little bit. And then the Marvel Unlimited subscription, you know, ebook reading thing came up and I have it under my name, but he's the one who primarily uses it. And now he started getting into reading X-Men.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah. And this is very topical considering who our guest is today. So speaking of her, we have Natalie Zena Walshots on, whose second book in the Hench series, Villain, is out where fine books are sold. How are you doing, Natalie?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Did you get Claude? Did you get Claude?
Right, I did now. Not get Claude, but there was a hilarious series of noises behind me. Let me tell you.
It was funny because your cat was like, no, I'm done.
I'm good. After like begging me to pick her up for like minutes on end, I'm like, okay, you can. And then disaster.
Yeah. No. It was hilarious.
You did it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So our listeners are not averse to hearing pet stories and cat stories. Mm-hmm. And I will say there have been times when we have been recording where Tracy's cats are quite literally trying to kill each other.
Oh, they're just brawling.
on the table that she uses when
Incredible.
She's recording. Like,
that was
they're
the
just
Louis Sacker episode, wasn't it? Where they were just like actually trying to Mortal Kombat each other.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
You could hear in the background this echoey voice going, finish him!
Yeah. Just like going full scorpion.
So one relatively peaceful cat, you know, that's very doable for us.
You know, taking half of my desk down on her. Sure, it's fine.
I mean, is it any surprise that the woman who's decided to sort of explore superheroism through the lens of the experience of villains is the owner of four cats? I'm not surprised.
Completely unsurprising, especially the two youngest are absolutely the universe getting back at me because they are career criminals. It is truly spectacular.
Okay, so we have to know about one of their highlighting exploits. Like, what's a gold star career exploit for these guys?
Mimi has stolen my engagement ring on three separate occasions and has taken it. Like, I will be putting lotion on and she will sneak up and grab it with her little mouth and run as fast as she can. and hide it for later. I assume to sell. I don't know what her plan is here.
It takes time when you don't have thumbs to set up the website. And,
absolutely. Yeah. It's like she's got a fence somewhere, I guess. I have found it every time, but my favorite hiding place was definitely inside of one of my slippers, like shoved into the toe of one of my slippers. So she's like, I'm going to come back for that later. So that's probably the best one. But I have watched her like with her little cat feet open a drawer and like pull out an item and then close the door and walk away with it.
The closing part is what sends me because she has an understanding that there's a need to hide her actions.
Well, then we will notice sooner, right? If the tiny drawer is left open, right? Mm-hmm. Then that's suspicious. So the problem solving is frankly a little out of control and unnecessary. As far as I've
told Tracy before about the dog that we had in the house when I was growing up. It was my mom's dog. That dog, name was Little Bit. Pekingese poodle, tiny little dog, hated everyone except my mom.
Like, right, classic.
Would growl and bark and bite and snap at you if you were not my mom. And one of the things that she did was she did not like when mom left the house. So she would gather all of mom's shoes in her bed. And then she had a little mattress in her bed. And then she would manage to get the mattress on top of all the shoes. So the shoes are underneath the mattress. And then she would lay on the mattress to hide that all the shoes are there. And so that way mom could not leave. Yeah. Yeah. So every single day, mom was like, where are my shoes? And she would go looking for them and be you'd hear her cussing somewhere in the house because she was trying to get them away from a little bit.
That's incredible.
Anyway, I love that. You wrote a book, I guess?
I wrote a couple of them. We're not here to talk about cats. At this point. Yeah. Book something. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, a couple of them. And the latest one is Villain. It is the second in the series, following the exploits of a youngish henchwoman as she sort of, I get her descent into increasing villainy, I suppose. This is the opposite of villain, as you might gather from the title, I suppose, is sort of the opposite of a redemption arc. It is a corruption arc.
Mm-hmm. You know what I've never understood? Mm-hmm. I don't understand how Riddler, Joker, and the rest of them in Gotham managed to find people willing to be their hench people.
Okay, so I've thought about this a lot. Perhaps it's surprising to you.
This is the correct line of questioning.
Else here. Yeah, because this exact question it was a huge impetus behind why I started writing hench to begin with and kind of developing what I like to think of as the henchiverse. And I know the moment it happened, I was rewatching the terrible Batman and Robin movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger is Mr. Freeze.
This is not a tumor.
But there's an incredible scene where there's like, I think it's a museum heist. It's like a gala heist. Yeah. And all of the henchmen are like, they like flood and then freeze the museum. And so all the henchmen come in on skates. So they're like evil, like hockey henchmen. And I'm like, okay, so where did you find this many ex like AAA or AA hockey players who are this behind on their child support? Like how does this happen? How have we gotten here? And just like that combination of like, okay, we need hyper specific talents or abilities, you know, like whether that's like can skate real good while doing violence or whatever, and a willingness to put your body in like real actual physical danger all of the time. Yeah. And you know, the work is definitely not legal and varying degrees of morally reprehensible. Like, where do you find these people?
And if Batman catches you, he's going to beat the shit out of you and break bones.
Absolutely. And like that, I mean, the other part of that is like Batman kills people, by the way. Like there is just no way that he doesn't, even if there is like there is no way he has done as much violence as he has done and as much severe violence without there being one, an accident, or two, if that person that you dropped down a fire escape and now has a complex spinal injury, if they die 2 years later because of sepsis from bed sores, that's still murder. Like, you still killed that guy. Like, certainly in our legal system, like, that is 100% murder. Like, you get upgraded to murder when that guy dies. And he does. So I just need to, like, pop that bubble real quick that, like, Batman is 100% has killed a lot of people, and I can prove it with math.
So you're talking about the really bad Batman and Robin movie there, but
yes,
my daughter has been a Batman fan since she was like 3 years old, and there's like a whole thing surrounding that. And actually, one thing that we did watch recently is the second season of Batman Cape Crusader on Amazon, which, you know, mixed reviews, but that's a whole other thing. And we afterwards went back to watching the Batman animated series from the 90s, which is what got her into Batman in the first place. But she fairly recently in the last year watched the Tim Burton Batman films with Michael Keaton. And there's a number of situations where he's got like a fucking bazooka, and like he takes out a building, and she would look at me and she was like, there is no way people didn't die.
Actually there is. So, so you have physics, right? So you have physics.
Yes. Allegedly.
You can actually only call it physics if it's math that comes from the physique region of France. Everywhere else,
it's just sparkling guesswork.
It's sparkling violence. Math. Yeah. Okay.
But so you have physics, but in Hollywood, they have what's called the A-team physics, which means that you can shoot a gun, an automatic weapon, directly at someone, and those bullets will travel all the way to them and then arc down at the last second and hit the ground. So when you get blown up by this bazooka in a Batman film, what it does is it actually does non-lethal violence at the last possible second. That's how that works.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see.
It's Hollywood physics.
Hollywood.
Or Hollywood sparkling math.
I suspect that Natalie superhero does not accept that.
Well, she's still explaining. We interrupted her.
Yes. Oh, no. Well, a big part of what I wanted to do with these books is challenge exactly that idea, right? Like that we see the superhero physics, right? Like we are exposed to superhero physics, which is exactly that. It's like, oh, somehow everybody lived and somehow all the violence is non-lethal and somehow, you know, like we see hench people used as effectively a punchline, both like metaphorically and literally, right? Like they're to be punched and then never seen again, or like, you know, have Captain America throw a hubcap or, you know, manhole cover into a guy's head and we're supposed to believe they're not dead. But they are, they super are. And I really wanted to stay with that, right? Like I really wanted to keep the camera, like usually in superhero stories, the camera is of course following the heroes, the people that we are supposed to care about, the like, you know, people doing all the big world altering events all of the time. And I really wanted to keep the camera on the person that we usually only see for like a second. So seeing their lives up until the moment of collision with a superhero, which is often extremely brief. And then afterwards having to really grapple with the often horrific repercussions of that. Because when we're only telling superhero stories from the perspective of the superheroes, we never see that, right? Like those are all kind of like incidental at most, like unfortunate consequences, right? You know, that, you know, but what if we didn't? What if we really stayed there and paid attention to the like potentially very horrific violence that was happening there? Which sounds like a bummer, but it and is and isn't, right? Like I think it's important. Like, I think it is valuable to kind of like, well, let's actually apply a lens of realism to this, which is, you know, certainly not the most unique idea in the entire world, right? Like The Boys is also doing this. There are lots of different superhero stories that are trying for a more like realistic or gritty or like in some way, physically more, more physical realism in kind of like, so less superhero physics, more realistic physics and realistic violence. But I also think it's important, or at least very interesting from like a speculative and also like a horror perspective. Like there's a lot of really cool, like innate and interesting body horror there. But there's also a lot of like personal and emotional and relationship consequences that come from that, right? Like there's a lot of those are, if we start looking at characters who are usually just there for 10 seconds to be a punchline, if we start looking at them as whole people, right? Entire people with like, you know, thoughts and feelings and dreams and motivations, not only does the violence get more horrific, but it gets infinitely, I think, more interesting when it's like, okay, well, how did this person get here? How does one become a former hockey player who could have made it big if it wasn't for that torn ACL, and you know, now they like are getting their wages garnished at every legitimate job that they have, because again, they're super behind on the child support. So like maybe they'll just take this gig. How bad can it possibly be? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I got so tired of waiting for someone else to write the book that I wanted to read, which was about that guy or that concept, or like, okay, how do we get here? And what happens when we keep the camera on those people, that I eventually gave up and started writing it myself.
See, and now I'm picturing what happened off screen in the Joel Schumacher Batman movie, where Mr. Freeze is like training his henchmen on how to skate.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think that would probably.
Okay, I'm going to freeze this, and then I'm going to need you to go on, and you're going to skate. Okay.
Okay, but they have to work out. They do. Is there? You know, do they like rent rink time? Right.
No, like, he's freezing like an area.
Yeah,
he's just freezing
like
the area.
Like training your kid to drive. You go to the empty parking lot.
Yeah. Oh my god, that's so funny. There's just, as soon as you start thinking about any of those implications, the results are almost always hilarious and at least really, really interesting. And so in a lot of ways, Henshin, now villain, is like, well, what if you just kept pushing that as far as you possibly could, right? Like, what if you like, yes, and that idea effectively infinitely?
Well, one of the taglines of the series is the line between good and evil is mostly marketing. And I think there's a sort of ironic hilarity to the fact that I noticed that while looking up the book on the Bezosaurus's giant marketing website, which interestingly also supplies a kind of subtitle to the first book in the series, Hench, A Novel of Heroism and Villainy in the Age of Social Media and Data Science, which I think is, it seems like the most accurate, if not the most intrinsically interesting elevator pitch version of like how all of this works. And at the risk of, since we're talking about book two in a series here, maybe giving away a little bit of the game on Hench, what changes for a character when they move from having been hench person to now a villain in their own right? Like, how does that kind of change that creative calculus that you've already been talking about?
Well, I think the short and kind of glib answer is like, that is villain, right? I think that is actually like a really good summary of what that book is. And for the auditor who has really been turning into a villain for some time, I would say like even fairly long before the events of villain, a lot of it has to do with a fierce clinging to and reclamation of agency, right? Like the position of the hench person is it is very innately one of subservience, right? Like you don't necessarily have much in the way of ambition of your own, and certainly not ambition that in any way competes with your employer, right? Like you are there as a tool. You are there to serve a purpose, even if that is just like be a distraction, right? But you have a very specific job to fill, in the accomplishment of somebody else's goals, right? Like that someone else has an idea that they want executed. You are executing a part of that idea. And part of that is, in a lot of ways, giving up a big chunk of your agency. I mean, this is also like literally any job, too, right? You know, but also, there are very particular and often terrible consequences when you're doing this as a hench person. But throughout Hench and certainly throughout Villain, we see the Auditor really caring more and more deeply about her own sense of agency, her own personal motivations, her own ambition, and her own sense of self and self-possession. And I think if there's anything that kind of defines villainy as we understand it from a narrative and certainly like in a comic book sense, it is that kind of like fierce individualism and fierce like clinging to one's identity and goals and passions and ambitions kind of above anything else, right? It is a selfish position, but it is a selfishness that comes from like this absolute anchoring to agency and free will. And I think that for the Auditor that no spoilers, but because of certain events that play out over the course of Villain, that becomes not only more and more important to her, but also she is sort of forced to confront that importance and make some really tough calls and to prioritize the preservation of that agency even more than she might have otherwise.
So I find myself thinking, and this is partly because I've been on a comics reading streak lately, about like the limitations of comics as a format. They're trying to negotiate that difference between actually having moving pictures on television and film and whatnot versus the total interiority of written narrative. And they're kind of trying to give us some way of participating in both at the same time. What about writing this as a novel, as opposed to saying, I want to find someone who is a talented artist and I want to create a comic that explores this. What about the novel gives you a tool set for doing exactly this kind of thing differently or better, maybe, than the type of comic that we might think of as kind of like the seed territory for this narrative?
This is a really good question. I will say that early on in the development of Hench, I did hire a comic artist and friend of mine, Shell Khan, to do some initial like character sketches and like character development on the Auditor Anna at the time. And that was extremely like helpful and important. And I don't think that Hench and Villain are completely like separate from comics in the sense that like there's a lot of obviously like shared DNA there, narratively speaking. But directly toward your question, when writing a novel, like you really can just do whatever you want, right? Like you can say a thing happens, you describe a thing, and there is no compromise on, is that something that like a person can draw? Is that something like a person is comfortable drawing? Like what even would that look like? And you are in a lot of ways, like it does allow you via an artist a greater kind of sense of creative control, right? Because you're deciding what it looks like. It's like, oh, it looks like this. This is how this character looks. This is how this event plays out. This is what the building looks like. Whereas with a novel, you are, one, you get to do whatever you want, but also you are trusting your audience, like you're trusting the reader with a really active kind of collaboration, right? Like you're trusting them to fill in those blanks. You're trusting them to imagine things. And you're also kind of letting that go, right? It's like, I don't have any control over how somebody pictures the auditor looking. I don't have any control over how, you know, somebody is imagining Leviathan looks in their head. And personally, I don't want it, right? Like I like love and welcome that collaboration. And I think that, you know, whatever a reader is imagining, like all the elements of that kind of creative process that writing can't do, that you're kind of handing to your reader and saying like, you know, do this with me. I love that. And like, I love hearing about the different ways in which people imagine the things that I have described. So I think that it's like, you're kind of giving up some pieces of control in exchange for other pieces of control and also for other kinds of collaboration, you know? So instead of that, like, you know, with comics, like that really intimate kind of collaboration between like writers and pencilers and inkers and colorists and letterers, right? Like you have this whole kind of, and whoever is, you know, doing the cover, and you know, that you have that really like beautiful, active, kind of minute to minute collaboration to make the thing. When you're writing a novel, like at the end of the day, like it is you and the word processor, right? Like it is you in the page trying to make a thing happen. But you get to keep all that control yourself, but then also you have to like let go more of it when interacting with your readership, with your audience. So mm-hmm. I think there's lots of interesting like components there, and it's for me it is mostly about like the kinds of collaboration I am not doing and the kind of collaboration I am like inviting in as a result. And there are lots of collaborative art forms that I love dearly. You know, I write video games fairly frequently, which is a intensely collaborative process. I've done a lot of TTRPG writing and like writing LARP scripts and things like that, which are, you know, very collaborative in their own in different ways. And they all have profound benefits and they all have like profound intimacies with audiences or readers or players or, you know, kind of whatever sort of form that like the consumer of the media takes. There all are benefits and they're all things that you're trading. But yeah, for writing a novel, it is definitely like you are keeping a lot of the control up front in order to give a lot more of it over later.
Yeah.
And in my personal experience, then you don't have to argue constantly with the artist who doesn't quote unquote get it,
right,
and wants to change everything.
Right. That is, of course, always a risk, right? Right. With any kind of collaboration. But I will say that, like, I have the greatest editor, right? Like, I'm working with David Pomerico at HarperCollins, and he got these books instantly. Like, he knew what I was trying to do, and working with him has been an absolute dream and has only ever made the book better for suggesting things.
That's
and
awesome.
Is also any moment where I've been like, I don't like, it's important that this stays in, or like, actually I'm doing this way for this reason. The answer has always been like, okay. He has always trusted me in that way as well. And I'm intensely grateful for that. I think that like a bad collaboration can be really devastating, and a good one can be
sure,
like life altering in the most positive way. So like there's also that risk too, right? Which like I haven't really talked about, but is absolutely real as well, right? Where like, you know, your collaborations can make the art so much better. They can also make the art so much worse. And there's kind of no way to know until you're there.
Yeah.
Making the thing. So there's also that.
I've done two kinds of collaborations like that in my life. One was a really good friend of mine from high school. Mm-hmm. Amazing artist, phenomenal artist, like just could draw like crazy. And at the time I was huge into comic books, and I said, hey, we should do a comic book.
Yeah.
And he's like, absolutely, let's do it. Miserable experience. Mm-hmm. Absolutely miserable experience. And then fast forward many, many years later, and I had a thing on my website called Conversations with My Cat that Chuck Wendig goes, why aren't you publishing this? You should be publishing this. And so an artist had reached out to me and said, hey, I think we should do a webcomic. Again, miserable experience for me. because that artist was just like, no, this isn't funny. I don't understand this. I don't get this. Why change this? Let's change this. Let's change that. Like constantly. And it was just driving me up a wall. Anyway, Tracy, you were thinking about that. I was thinking about this scene from Justified. And there's a moment in one of the seasons of Justified where this guy's in trouble and he owes money to like the Dixie Mafia or somebody like that. I can't remember who. But he's good friends with a former NFL football player. Huge guy, muscle guy. Looks like, you know, he's really fit and good. And so the NFL guy's like, well, I'm going to help you, the football player. I'm going to help you. We're going to get these guys off your back. And they go to confront like the bad guys. And but the bad guys know that this NFL player, why he wasn't in the NFL anymore, like he blew out his knee. So as soon as he starts trying to be the tough guy, they just go after the knee and they take him down and they beat the crap out of him. And for some reason, like that reminds me of Hench, like henchmen, right?
The hench who does their homework.
Yeah. It's like they know. I don't know. But that's where my brain went when you were talking about like the just all of the kind of shit that goes into the whole idea of a hench person, right? As kind of being like a distraction and stuff. Well, here's the villain. And the villain's like, I'm a little bit smarter than you. Whack. And just goes after the knee and takes this guy down. Mm-hmm. That's where my brain went. But of course, my brain always squirrels. So.
No, I think that that's like, I mean, in a lot of ways, and I make some distinctions in both hench and villain between, like the henchmen who are like what we probably think like the first draft edit of what you think, you know, like
the red shirts.
Yeah. Like big dude who kneecaps somebody. Right. Yeah. Like that who are generally referred to as like meat, as in like meat shield in the book. So you're sort of like, this person is not being paid to think at all. Like that is not what their job is. They are due to perform a physical task, often with violence involved.
They are there to get their ass kicked dramatically by John Wick.
Exactly. And that is the whole reason that they are there. Yep. But you also do want hench people who can outsource some of that thinking, right? And I think that there's probably a direct correlation to the success of villains at a high level who are willing to outsource a certain amount of that, like actually high grade decision making to highly, highly competent people, right? That there is, you know, the sort of like, in the same way that the idea of the lone hero is just like not true, the idea of the, you know, kind of like perfect isolated villain is also just not true. Like you do need other people doing very, very, very good work, possibly in some ways better than you could do it yourself in order to like really like knock it out of the park, right?
Kingpin needs Tombstone and he needs the Rose.
Yes.
And he needs them to be smart enough, but not so smart or ambitious enough that they're going to come after him and try to
exactly. And that's really like the very fine line, right? Like that kind of line between competence and loyalty, or not between competence and loyalty, the combination of competence and loyalty, right? Mm-hmm. Is a very tough balance to strike. Because at a certain point, you know, you're like the danger with ultra hyper competent people is that they may start trusting themselves more than they trust you and or they are maybe more loyal to themselves than they are to you, and that is, there's always that like danger there, whereas somebody who is only there to perform a task and their entire value is tied up in their being there and being present and executing that task well, you don't have the same kinds of problems. Like if that person like double crosses you, like, so what, who cares? Like what you, they're not, it doesn't really matter. Whereas if somebody who like knows all your OPSEC and like has some very important passwords and like knows some personal shit about you, like they decide to do something different, like that's a very different prospect, right? Like that is a very, you know, that's dangerous in a different kind of way. And while that's like certainly not like at the absolute center of these books, is definitely, I mean, the OPSEC for sure is Like I'm, but the like that tension is certainly always kind of present and there, and again is something that like I think is very, very interesting.
Well, at this point, I think picks of the week are very, very interesting.
We'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere. But you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it. A lot of other people are enjoying it. But our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love. You get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, can you give us a pick?
Yes, Tracy, I can. So last time or maybe the time before, I picked a new book from Paizo called Impossible Magic. Mm-hmm. This time I'm on a couple of subscriptions with Paizo for Pathfinder stuff. And they have sent me this gorgeous adventure path called Bastion of Blasphemies.
Ooh.
By James Jacobs.
Oh, that cover is gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The listeners can't see it, but it's a really nice cover. And this is an adventure path that's more of a horror themed. Mm-hmm. There's this rundown ruins of a castle that people are afraid of and they never go there. And then once every 100 years, it kind of comes back to life. And a mysterious carriage starts roaming the roadways around the town and in the castle. And if it stops and asks you to get in, like the headless driver of it stops and asks you to get in and you refuse, you mysteriously die within a few days. But if you get in, you are taken and never seen again. So, like, it's a catch 22. You don't really get a good shot. This is for level 5, I believe, to start, and probably takes you all the way up to like 15 ish. It's good stuff. I really, I do I've said it before, I appreciate all the lore that goes into the Pathfinder world and everything that they do and all the stuff that they write. And James Jacobs does a lot of stuff that I like. So I'm very happy to have this particular book.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So Natalie, how about you?
Am I allowed to have two? Or
do no, I have two? Never, okay, never. Right. No, we always tell people that. No, you can have two.
Okay, what excellent. Because I have a book and I have a record. Okay. I'm going to start with the record, which is by Antigen Shift, who are industrial. There's some metal happening in there. There's some doom happening in there. There's definitely a lot of like EBM and some experimental noise. And they've just come out with a new record, Verified Unidentified. They're a duo, one of whomst is my partner. And I promise I am not just talking about this because he's my partner and very handsome. But this record is great. And it is, I think, pretty indisputably the best thing that they have ever done. It sounds like, I've been listening to it a lot, and it is the soundtrack to a like 80s-ish cyberpunk, like retro futurist horror movie. Like every single song is like the lead up to it sounds like boss battle music, right? Like it sounds like cyberpunk Bloodborne, which is something I, you know, an aesthetic I didn't know I needed until it arrived in my life. So it's fantastic. I've been listening to it a lot because I can't listen to music that has like lyrics all of the time. And there's a lot of, or intelligible lyrics. So there's a lot of really great long instrumental passages here. And the vibes are just absolutely fantastic. So Verified Identified by Antigen Shift. They're wonderful. And while this is not a new book, I'm also going to call out Between Two Fires by Christopher Buhlmann, which is a medieval horror novel about a disgraced knight with traveling with a priest and a young girl through plague-ridden France in, I think, the 12th century. Because this like 13-year-old girl is like, I have to talk to the Pope. It's really important. And it's fantastic. it's fantastic. It has some of the best, weirdest found family relationships I have read in a long time. It has some of the best monsters in a horror novel I have encountered in a very long time. The like emotional core of this book is great. It is genuinely horrifying and brutal, and some of the body horror in there is like very difficult, which I love. And it's just like I have not stopped thinking about it since I read it, and I think it came out in 2012 at this point, so like not new, but new to me. And it really, really rearranged my brain and made me realize that I desperately want more medieval horror to exist on the earth, it turns out, as a genre.
Awesome. Mm. All right. So I just got back about a week ago, slightly less than a week ago, from a kind of short family vacation to Milwaukee. I live in the Chicago area, so Milwaukee's not all that far away. And although as a lifelong Chicago area native, we have a kind of adversarial relationship with Wisconsin in many ways, I found Milwaukee to be absolutely delightful. And during the course of that trip, we made a stop at a comic book store, a friendly local comic book store, because it would make my son happy. And while he was grabbing some stuff and shopping for some things, I found some goodies for myself too. And I discovered late, as I always do with these sorts of things, the 2021 Harley Quinn series by Stephanie Nicole Phillips yes. and Riley Rosmo. So I got the first three volumes of it, and I have been reading them, and it is just a delight. And so to timestamp it for those of you who have some Batverse familiarity in the last like decade or so, this particular version of a Harley Quinn series picks up after she's been discharged from the Suicide Squad and after the Joker War. And so with that landscape, she got some splaining to do, and she's on essentially a kind of apology tour of a return to Gotham, where she's decided, no, I'm not just going to be like an anti-hero kind of Suicide Squad thing. I'm going to become good with a capital G. And of course, she's kind of terrible at it. For a wide variety of reasons. And so what I love about the series so far, is it like deeply intellectual and chewy? No, not by any stretch of the imagination. But the art style and the kind of character work that's being done in it is just really on point for something that feels like a adult successor to your Bruce Timm kind of origin story, Harley Quinn stuff. And so it scratches all the itches for me. I've been really enjoying it. If you haven't gone back to look at the Phillips Brosmo Harley Quinn books, it's really, really very worth your time.
Very cool.
That sounds rad as heck.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. All right. So here we go. We are at the end of all things, or at least the end of this thing, which means we need to have you, Natalie, help remind folks of where to find you and all your super cool stuff.
I can be found on the internet, in particular these days on Blue Sky at Natalie Zed. So N-A-T-A-L-I-E-Z-E-D. If you see that username, the odds of it being me are pretty high, though, of course, not guaranteed. And you can find both Hench and Villain anywhere you want to buy a book, pretty much. It is available at like all major online retailers. It's available via like the indie bookshop network, like both online and again, like a lot of it is
brick and mortar.
It's very frequently in person right now too, very happily. So if it's a place you can buy a book, you can probably get it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. This is delightful.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook, at functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way, so hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know, I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening, and I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake. Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, I really love what you do," I'm like, "I'm sorry. Do you know who I like? I think you have me confused with someone else."
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.